We are not heroes, nor are we villains, neither kings nor magicians, but we can tell you their stories. We are the Lore Keepers, and we welcome you to Hallowmay.
Welcome, Frank, to Hallowmay. This is Lore Keepers, the Boundless Venture, the world-renowned podcasting opus, wherein the richest tapestry of lore in human history is sung into being before your very ear holes. I'm Carter.
And I'm Frank.
And whether you melt jewelry in goddamn volcanoes, burn steel to usurp the Carrion Throne, or crit on your fucking Grey Warden to kick flip, sit a while by our fire, ho ho ho, weary wanderer, and let us weave you
say that
a tale.
So weird.
This half fortnight, we're talking about, we're back to Padasari. We're talking about a good old boy hanging out in Padasari. Who knows exactly what they are, but they are a benevolent figure in the history of Padasari, and they're kind of like your neighborhood superhero, Spitterin. You'll see the connection, Frank, when we get into the episode. But before we begin, how you doing?
What is this energy that you are bringing in? I cannot place this. Shit, dude. Man, Carter's intense today. He had some ideas about like what he's going to take the lead on this one, folks, and frankly, I don't. Oh, god damn it.
Nice.
I can never. It's weird to have a word in the English language that specifically you just cannot say. Just can't.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, folks, I have no idea where he's going with this. I'm doing okay. Realized I said no preamble, and I don't think there will be one. But Carter, remind me, at the end, I had a question for you about Battlebox.
Oh.
About magic, and maybe you can help Rachel and I figure out some solutions to some problems we are having.
Sure, sounds good.
But aside from that, I'm just looking forward to getting into finding out what you're talking about. Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and I'm ready to get into the episode, Frank. So let's get started.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So we need to zone back in on Padasari. And
yes,
I was thinking that we did a somewhat dastardly figure a few episodes ago. So let's do something with a little bit more positive energy. So I thought,
okay,
I'm going to tell you some things, Frank, and you're going to like it. You ready?
All right. Yeah. Really quick. And then just you can go off. For the listener, if you are curious, and maybe you skipped some episodes or just popping in or whatever, the figure that Carter's talking about is Iulia Anno, who initiated and engaged the Anno occupation. If you want to check that out, links or information's in the podcast description. All right, go for it, man.
There is a merfolk.
Okay.
They live in... Are you ready for this?
No, probably not.
A giant clam.
Okay.
Which is in the bay betwixt the harbor district and Padasari itself.
Okay.
And every day they go on to, they catch some fish, they go on to land in Padasari in their little fucking weird water go-kart.
You talking about the radio flyer with a Rubbermaid container
exactly.
on it?
That's the one. They wheel okay. into the central marketplace and they hand out fresh fish to like orphans and people in need. And then
all
just,
the good girls and boys.
Exactly.
Another.
And they're like, and I'm saying they because we haven't rolled for any gender yet. I don't want to gender them just yet. And they just talk to people and they see how they're doing. They talk to people how their days are going. They talk about what people's projects are. They're just, you know, this real happy figure.
They're the Mr. Rogers of fish.
They're the Mr. Rogers, yes.
In every fish. Sense of yes. that word.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Do they have a cardigan that they wear?
I think it's a little bit less cardigan energy. It's more like, I don't know what kind of fucking, maybe they have like some fancy, coral, like shoulder pads. That's probably as close as you'll get.
Okay.
Maybe they have like a hat, sure. Like a big coral hat. I don't know.
All right. Cool. Okay. All right. I gotta say, it's an awful lot like Lorekeeper shit posting right now, but I'm so here for it. Yeah. Keep going, man. You're on a roll. What's the deal with them? What's going on here?
They're just super fucking happy, and they're kind of just like this figure that everyone knows because everyone's talked to them at some point. And like a lot of times when they come around, people just like go and chat with them, and it's like this weird like this figure that like. No one really knows, like, did they just start doing this? And there's very, people, like, ask them, like, why you just, like, get on land and just come and talk to us? And, like, why do you hand all these fish? And they're like, I'm just trying to be, you know, people pleaser, hanging out.
Okay, so when Carter pitched this episode to me, in my mind, I was imagining a figure akin to... He's talking about a benevolent figure that like people could connect to and stuff and would appreciate in their community. And for some reason, I guess in my mind interpreted that as like Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, who is recognized basically as like the everyone's grandfather of Turkey, who basically modernized the country. Like required like education of children to I think 14 and like women I think were given the right to vote and basically made Turkey into a modern country after World War One. This is not that. This is not Ataturk, who's got like a picture, like pretty much in any business with a person over the age of 60 in it. They've got like a portrait of him on the wall somewhere. This is not that. This is a very different kind of energy you're bringing here. All right, man. So this is basically just a nice person.
Yep.
Cool.
But what's weird is that there's very little known about this nice person. And I mean, we can go further, Frank. They can become the grandfather of Turkey.
I mean, sure. I mean, maybe you'd mentioned Socrates when you were talking about this as like an inspiration. Yeah. I didn't know Socrates liked to hand out fish.
I mean, we have to change things up to the kids. Can't just be Socrates.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. I gotta start somewhere. Shit, dude. Okay. Carter, I think the beginning is great. Where do we go from here?
It's a good question. I mean, this is kind of a Lorekeeper Jr., so we don't have to go that far. Maybe they get elected president.
I mean, maybe. Okay, let's add a little bit of, I love the color. Let's actually draw some line work now so we can see what we're looking at here.
All right, do we want to roll for gender or do we want to leave them genderless?
Oh well, yeah, we can roll for gender. Yeah, you wanna roll? Should I roll a D8 and you wanna roll a D6?
All right, I'll roll the D6.
All right, D8 is a 3, so they have a binary gender.
6.
Okay, so they are. I think odd is male, so I think even is female, so that's a she.
All right, so we have our lady mermaid.
She is a mermaid.
Yep.
Not a merman.
Running around.
Well, not really. Never actually running around. Also, really quick side note. Can you paint the picture of this go-kart for me? I'm not really. How do you sit in it as a merfolk? Is it like a recumbent bicycle where you're like leaning back or something?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Yeah. Yeah.
How does it. Is it heavy? Is it she? Does she have it being pulled by somebody?
You know, I think.
How does she talk to people? Does she pop her head up and then talk and then like bring it back down again?
Well, I get the feeling like, here's a question for you. Can merfolk breathe air?
I don't know. I mean, we could make a decision, or we could check the 5e tools.
Let's do both. Let's check and make a decision. I think that's the best.
All right. Merfolk.
They're amphibious.
Okay. They can breathe air and water. All right.
So yeah, I get the feeling that it's like they have their tail. Like, they like their tail to be constantly in water. It's just more comfortable that way. They don't want to dry out.
Mm-hmm.
But then they you know, then the rest of it, like above the midriff, is just like a, you know, like a chair kind of thing, maybe slightly reclined. And then they have like maybe like a paddle that they they get going, and they can use to break and stuff.
And I think that there is some water that they have with them to keep them wet.
Oh yeah, it's in the Rubbermaid.
Yep. So it really is just like a trough that has. I think it might have brakes as well.
Yeah, they have like a lever.
I'm pretty sure and most of Hadasari is built on an incline. Yeah. So there's a lot of.
I think there's like like semi regular, maybe like semi annual or like bi monthly. Merfolk races, like, mm-hmm. And it's not limited to exclusively merfolk, but like merfolk uh-huh. are the best at it because they just do it more.
But, I mean, maybe that's the competition. This is like everyone races, and then one, you know, the fastest person can race against the merfolk.
Maybe
and the merfolk
yeah.
always win,
and they just get something fucking like wrecked, and the merfolk are like drifting around corners and shit. It's pretty great.
This is so absurd. God, that picture never got any less absurd.
That's the point. It's meant to be kind of absurdist and, like, fun. That's what this figure is. It's like, everyone knows this person's name. Everyone's mm-hmm. like, of course I know that person. And everyone's like, they're great.
All right. Really, really quick also, I think it is worth noting that in Magic the Gathering, there's a lot of different imagery of merfolk, and a lot of them actually do have legs, but I do like that ours don't. Yeah, I like that ours actually don't. Just have a tail. It's far more practical for their lives, for the most part.
I'm sure that there are, like, some merfolk who... The merfolk who are magicians probably can give themselves legs.
Well, and this is kind of what I was wondering is I was like, maybe there's a more permanent solution that happens in the future if she ends up spending a lot of time above water.
I think that the part of the inspiration for this this mermaid is that where she's from, it's like very chill, and like everyone's mm-hmm. besides the giant like kraken occasional or like giant crab attacks, we're like.
Hey, what's the deal with the clam that she lives in, by the way? That's like a very SpongeBob movie.
It is very SpongeBob, you're right.
Yeah.
But it's just like...
How do you like Mazami?
I think that's great, Mazami.
Or Nalaro?
Let's do Mazami.
Mazami.
People call her Mezi.
Mazami. Mazami Elam, Mazami Neck, Mazami Vettel.
Mazami Vettel.
Mazami Vettel, okay.
And,
I like that.
And she goes by... A lot of people call her Mezi.
Yeah, or Mez. Mezcal.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. This is fun. So, yeah. So, we've got Mazami. What was it?
Vettel?
Vettel? Yeah. Mazami Vettel. Why is she this nice? Why is she giving fish to people?
I mean, people need fish. That's what she says.
Maybe she's just generous. Maybe she, when she was younger, she grew up hearing the stories of the tidelings. It doesn't have to be complicated. Yeah, I think, I mean, it's just, it can be somebody who genuinely just wants to make sure there's as much benevolent or like positive light in the world as possible. And so she's, you know, seeking to... Yeah, provide for people.
Yeah, and I think that there has been...
I think it's more than just fish, by the way.
Yeah, it's more than just fish. There's shells, it's coral.
Yeah. She's the kind of person... Okay, I'm starting to get a picture. She's the kind of person, same sort of tribe as, like, as Gandhi, where they really just don't believe in living a life of holding on to things for themselves. Like the life is there, the most delight and the most joy in life is found in doing things for others. And like, I think she like genuinely has a lot of joy for making like jewelry or like, you know, pottery or other things. I don't know, not pottery maybe, but like, you know, well, actually a pottery from a coral dust, kind of like dirt analog, like could be kind of cool. But like, you know, she's creating things and then she gives them all away to people. And I think the people provide for her. Every evening, somebody invites her into their home. She like really, what's the word? It embodies sort of this ideal that the Parasarians elevate as like generosity, you know, true charity, where she doesn't hold anything back for herself.
Yeah, and I think that, you know how we have the like political structure of the Parasari with like the clerics we were talking about before, and another one, the clerics of, I forget who it was. It was a goddess of law, I think.
Or conflict resolution. Yeah, let me see if I can pull that up really quick, just because that was a really cool episode. Because
I think Mezzi is like an honorary member, and like a lot of people go to Mezzi to help with problems. And she is always has like very thoughtful solutions and is very good at mediating.
Wernenthal.
Yeah, Wernenthal.
Yeah. Or Wernenthal. Yeah, I like that. I think it makes sense. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what kind of relationship she has to the clerics proper. But I think that it is definitely the kind of person where it's like nobody wants to harm her because she is so generous. And so even the mean-hearted are like, it just wouldn't even make sense to hurt a person like that. Why would you?
Yeah.
It's not even pragmatic. It's not useful to do that.
You know, maybe at some point Thaw gave her like the key to the city or something. That sounds like something that could have happened. That sounds like a filler episode in this anime.
Uh-huh. Definitely. Sorry, now I'm just looking at a bunch of pictures of merfolk. yes, I think that she garners a sort of attention. Yeah, I think that she's more of a cultural object in the fabric of Parasari than ever a political one. Yeah, maybe absolutely. She gets a key to the city from Thog or something, but I don't think she ever holds political office.
No.
I don't think that would really be attractive to her. Mazami, right? Mazami Vital?
Mm-hmm. Mezzi.
Yeah, I think that, like, ultimately, that's not useful to her. It's not real to her in a way, I think. It's not very, like, the world is what she can see and touch in a lot of ways. And so she is gifting all of this because she sees all of the pain. But I think that she lasts in the cultural psyche in a way that a lot of political figures never will. You know, I mean, in the way that things do in Parasari, where like she becomes a tideling story. I think that she like long lives after her own death.
Yep.
As a returning soul, an actual soul, where it's almost like the you know, the stories that are told about the fabric of Parasari and like the magic that surrounds it has granted her special permission to return whenever she likes or something. And it actually is her soul as an individual returning to grant and gift people.
I think
Sorry, go ahead.
I think that her kind of presence caused a kind of an interesting perception of merfolk, where the people of Parasari see merfolk as being like very kind and generous because of her.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they don't interact with merfolk all that often.
In a way where the merfolk are totally fine with this. Like, I kind of think maybe she didn't. She was sort of a pariah.
Yeah, they were like, who the fuck? Like, she's so fucking weird. Like, why is she?
She's just weird. I mean, she's like, again, you know, two for two. She's Ariel, you know?
Yeah.
Why does she care so much about this world above the waves? Fuck, we made the Little Mermaid.
We did.
You made the Little Mermaid.
I did.
But no, I mean, but like, actually, there is, I think, something interesting there when you have, you know, the people she's been rejected from her own people for some reason. Maybe a weird sort of archaic. We don't know a lot about the merfolk and merfolk culture, but I think it could be interesting to say that there is sort of the sins of the father are visited on the child to the X number of generations or something. And maybe she was orphaned or something. But like the point is I think that there is some, and we don't need to go super dark emo here, but like, I think for anybody like that, they know what it's like to be hurt and to not be a part of a circle, and they never want anybody else to feel the way that they have felt. And that is like, I think that it can be a really strong motivating thing for people with that kind of generosity, that the deepness of it, because they know what it's like to feel completely cut off from your people, to be alone.
Yeah, so I think that there might be outside of merfolk circles, Frank, there might be like 5 people that know her story, and she made them promise not to tell anyone because she thinks it's a sad story and she doesn't want people to be sad.
Right.
Like exactly. That is exactly.
She doesn't want to associate and like let that, and she even, you know, kind of requested of them, like, you know, please do not share this. Let that tale be forgotten from the tidelings. Like this world does not need more pain.
Yeah.
Exactly. It is, you know, the last thing she wants to do is provide anybody with, you know, a suggestion of any more pain than, you know, than there already is, which again, I mean, honestly kind of is a Mr. Rogers thing too. Like there is, like, Mr. Rogers was a person who, he wasn't sad and he wasn't a broken person inside. He genuinely just, you know, I think there's actually a couple of really good documentaries out there. I know there's the Tom Hanks movie where he plays Mr. Rogers that I heard was actually really good too. But like based on these, you know, documentaries and stuff, it sounds like he genuinely was just a person who wanted, you know, and it genuinely wasn't about having the spotlight on him. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think that lasts. It's like the people of Padasari have been through a lot over the years, and they need somebody like that to believe in and to believe that can be good. And I think that Mizami,
Vital.
Yeah, Mizami, I think her name becomes like synonymous with the heart of Tencetong or Padasari, where it's like the people even use her as like a reference point of like, you're not behaving like Mizami in this, like for like scolding a child for being selfish or like not playing with their or not sharing something with their siblings or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's synonymous
of with like, would Mizami do that? You know,
it's how we say like Benedict Arnold, like you're Benedict Arnold.
Yeah,
you're a traitor.
Or even honestly like a what would Jesus do kind of thing of like a, hey, you know, this is a figure who is elevated in the culture in a way where people use her as a waypoint or a lighthouse to make sense of when things she is a rock that people cling to, or her ideology when things are really bad or they go through a tumultuous period. Like I'm kind of thinking for some reason that this happened before the Anno occupation and that she actually was an inspiration. I don't think she was around during the Anno occupation, but that she was an inspiration and a guiding light. I'm going to use that word lighthouse again, because all of this isn't very nautical. But she was like a light, I think, ooh, you know, we could have stories that during the occupation, there were times, because the tidelings were still happening during
that.
There were times when she would arrive on the shore and provide relief to the people. And she would literally come bearing gifts and you know, food and, you know, and maybe wouldn't always be seen, you know, but definitely enough times to know that, like, she became a legend as a result.
I think that that and legends of that kind of are what is the modern Avum Pentis, a ceremony of the king and the queen, I think, of Tidelings.
Yes, I was just thinking that. Yes, is that they are, she is seen as like, I think in a lot of ways she might be seen as the mother of Padasari, again, in a way that lasts far longer than any political campaign. Like, Thog is there, and Thog is like, everyone's like, well, of course, like, Thog is, you know.
But Thog is maybe like Thog, the grease behind
Thog
the wheels.
Is, if Mizami is the mother of Parasari, Thog is the father. And it's like the political ideology and the spirit of Parasari embodied in these two figures, in a way where it's like, that sort of Dia de los Muertos slash Christmas holiday that we have, Tides Day or whatever, maybe it's the prince and princess, and it's almost seen as like the sires, the scions of Mizami.
I see.
And yeah, and I think, I mean, so let's see. Oh, because yeah, no, you totally nailed that. I feel like there was one other thing that I was gonna say though. What were we talking about? Oh yeah. Yes, this. That I think that so with the whole like providing relief and aid and the fact that the De los Muertos holiday, I think also is something that kind of becomes popularized later. I think that Mizami might have been around near the beginning of Parasari, like when it first starts to really build up as a ship, like some of the first society that gets built there. It's mostly just kind of trading port. You know, there's like, you know, somebody figured out, hey, we could actually make some money here if we charge these ships or whatever. And it's mostly just like some docks, you know, and the ships are occasionally showing up and then more ships start showing up and it's like, oh shit, you know, like, and this is kind of how Parasari as a city is built, because, you know, the island up until that point hadn't really had much activity beyond maybe this very, very small village that Parasari was then built on top of. And I think around this time, maybe there's some stuff going on with the merfolk. I don't think we necessarily need to relate it to the whole commerce and stuff. Maybe there's some Marian Dominion fallout. Who's to say? But Mizami, you know, her family, you know, maybe not recognized. Maybe it was just a mother or father who'd been looking after her and then they died because, you know, not really any community support. Like nobody, I think, killed them, but yeah, they just were ousted. But she sees these people, you know, and she sees that they're trying to live a life for themselves and having a really rough time of it. And in the next 20 and 30 years, as the city really starts to explode, like she builds a relationship with the people of this small village that turns into a much more bustling trade port, and continues to do this. And then like, you know, as the legends go and as the legends can be seen today, you know, or whatever the present is at the moment, long after her death, Mizami is still seen, you know, coming bearing gifts and offering things to the people of Parasari.
Yeah, I think like in the biggest bustling marketplace where she went, there is like a big statue of like a big clam and she's like,
yeah, yes, and she's like bursting out of it like Venus.
Exactly.
For sure. And I mean, the humor of this too is the fact that like these aren't, you know, being a tideling isn't necessarily like a clandestine thing. Like she might, when she like, you know, and I don't think she wakes up on the shore, I think she strides out of the ocean, you know, when she returns. And I think she's just like straight up has, you know, brings her giant, you know, how whatever cargo she is carrying, she just brings it directly into the largest square and just starts offering it, or this one specific square,
yeah,
you know, that is the same place that she's been. It's maybe the last piece of the original village that has remained, that hasn't been converted. It was the village square, the village green, or or, you know, whatever was there, because it's the one place that like, well, we don't want to get rid of this, because then where would, you know, Mizami go? She'd have to go somewhere else. And maybe there's some fear that she might not ever come back if they remove it. There's some sort of some superstition there. So yeah, shit, man. We did some, it's a good basis. I like it.
Yep. It's nice to have some positivity.
Yeah. Amen to that. I think that might actually cover it, though.
I think so, yeah.
Oh, jeez.
I think we have, like, in that square where she was living, you know, she has the beautiful statue. And then in the big, like, political square where all the political buildings are and the lore keepers are, is a very weird artistic rendition of, like, just Thog emerging from the sea. just walking.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I love it. Like fucking Sandman from Spider-Man 3 climbing out of the sand. I mean, maybe there's like a Mizami is sort of beckoning him or something, you know, like sort of the lore of the past has been rewritten to sort of imagine that even, you know, he was a result of her coming or something. Cool. Yeah. I really like this. All right. Thanks everyone for letting us be your escape. Thanks to Carter for this one. If you forgot your worries and you want to make others forgetful, we are on every podcasting service known to humankind. So don't be greedy. If they've got a different podcasting service than you do, your friends can still listen to us talk about the mother and father of Padasadi. Mm.
Did we discuss something that was confusing as hell?
I'm pretty sure Thog doesn't have genitals, by the way.
Of course.
And I'm not sure how the fish eggs of a merfolk works.
We talked about Thog's genitals. But chances are there's some context in the podcast description. So go
right
there.
As screaming in the last milliseconds before we hit the finish line there.
You can also explore the subreddit or reach us at TheLoreKeepers on Twitter or email us at TheLoreKeepersPodcast@gmail.com. LoreKeepersPodcast@gmail.com for questions or things you'd like to hear in future episodes.
Thanks again, of course, to Josh Silker for who is the composer of a Land of Heroes, the Lore Keepers theme. And of course, thanks to Sam Wade for the beautiful artwork. You can find Sam's work at By Sam Wade on Instagram or check the podcast description for the link.
Until next time, don't forget, there are always more gifts to give.
Oh, that's good. I like that. I almost want to say Merry Christmas, everyone, but it's probably like mid-March when this comes out. Happy St. Patrick's Day? Is that in March?
Sure. It is
I
now.
Don't know. Whatever.
It is
Happy
now.
Spring times. All right. Love y'all. Be safe. Bye.